Hello and welcome to another episode of the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. I'm your host, Richie Billing, and today I'm absolutely delighted to bring you an episode that has had me giddy with excitement in anticipation of sharing it with you. Not long ago, I reached out to one of my favourite authors, an award-winning author of scores of fantasy and science fiction books, all of them absolutely excellent. Adrian Tchaikovsky. He's a writer at the top of his field, and very speculatively I reached out to him to ask if he'd be interested in coming onto the show to chat about something that a lot of listeners have emailed into me about, which is the writing process as a whole, turning ideas into fully fleshed stories and novels. It turned out to be a fascinating and extremely insightful chat. I had a lot of fun editing the episode, which can be a very tedious process, but it's something that I've really enjoyed listening back to again, and it's something that I'm gonna go back and listen to again in the future, because Adrian, as you'll see, shares so many fantastic insights about the writing life, and not only just to do with the writing process itself, but working with agents, working with publishers, and psychological challenges when it comes to writing as well, such as keeping focused and imposter syndrome. So it's gonna help, I'm sure, and I certainly hope it does. Before we get to the interview, I'd just like to remind you that if you haven't already done so, to please follow or subscribe to the show. This is a fantastic way to show your support for what we do, and it gives us encouragement to keep on producing content and to get more fantastic guests like Adrian Tchaikovsky on. So yeah, please do follow, subscribe. If you have a few seconds to spare, please leave a quick rating on Spotify mobile app, or a quick review on iTunes or the other platforms that you may listen to the show on. If you haven't already done so as well, please share the show with anyone you know who think may be interested or may benefit from the kind of topics that we talk about, or even just a quick share on social media. That just helps us immensely, because we don't benefit anything financially from the show. We barely cover the costs, so we've got to rely heavily on the goodwill of listeners like you. So thank you very much. If you'd like to carry on your learning beyond the show, head over to our Patreon page, where you can find lots of writing classes, courses, workshops, interviews with myself. You can find books, you can find articles and guides. I've recently put a load of new content on Patreon, so it's all kicking off there. And a place that's really thriving at the moment is our community writing group. We've had scores of new members, everyone getting involved, supporting each other with their writing and their social media and marketing efforts, and also with the crucial things like beta reading and giving feedback and encouragement. So important, and a lot of people getting a lot of great benefits. So if you'd like to join us, just click the link in the description. Links for everything else that I've mentioned there are in the description too. And now that is enough from me. It's time to introduce Adrian Tchaikovsky for a fantastic and insightful chat about the writing process. I am honored and delighted to welcome a very special guest today, award-winning author of science fiction and fantasy, Adrian Tchaikovsky. Adrian, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today.
Not at all. Thank you for having me on the show. I can just say, I know it's been a while now, but the words award-winning author still sound make me have an enormous stamp of imposter syndrome. and I just have to, that is actually a thing that happened, and it's not.
Well, I was actually just checking, doing a bit of research for our chat, and I hadn't realised how many awards he's actually won.
It's been a good few years.
And I know this year could be an exciting year as well, because you've been nominated for the Hugo Award.
The Hugo and the Locus, neither of which I think I have a dog's chance of winning, because frankly, the competition for both is absolutely stellar. But yeah, I mean, I, as of as of last year, I finally started to make a bit of an impact on the US awards scene, which is not a thing that was the case before then. So that's, which is really nice. I mean, it's as purely as a barometer of reaching a new audience to that kind of level is absolutely marvelous.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, well, congratulations, and I think you've got a good chance. Elder Races, I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but the reviews have been amazing, and I love the idea, the premise behind it. So
yeah, it's quite surprising that it's taken off really, really well over in the US, and it's not necessarily the book I would have thought. Yes, obviously this is the one that will crack that particular market. So it just goes to show, you can never tell.
Yeah, I might ask you later on about how you managed to get into the US market.
I'll do my best. I'm not entirely sure I know.
But yeah, the reason why I asked you to go on the show is we had loads of listeners reaching out to me lately asking about the writing process, which is basically turning ideas into fully formed stories. And what we like to do on this show is reach out to experts and masters of the craft like yourself, just to get an idea of what you do yourself, what kind of processes you follow. Because I don't know if you've ever felt like this in the past. I know I have, and still do. Like I say, about imposter syndrome, I get that all the time. I get quite self-conscious about how I write, and other people have mentioned this to me as well, and whether you're doing it right, or whether you've missed something, or whether there's anything we can do to make it more efficient and effective. So where best place to start, I suppose, is the idea phase, and mm-hmm. where do you find inspiration for your ideas? And I know you love insects. We see them a lot in your stories, spiders in particular, and the Shadows of the App. I love the insect crossover there. So how do you get your inspiration for your stories?
I think the main thing is just having a very, very acquisitive mind, because basically I will be constantly, I mean, I read a lot, and you know, I also read a certain amount of kind of scientific literature and so forth, not as much as I should, frankly, but I still, you know, I take in articles and I listen to podcasts and that kind of thing, and it all basically goes in. And every so often it will then come back out again saying, well, all right, this is how it is, but what if? So far, I mean, the best example of this, Children of Time, which is obviously the book that very much has made me as an author, is entirely inspired by some research done by Dr. Fiona Cross on the Portia labiata spider and its behavior. And that went in because, you know, as you say, I'm a big fan of spiders and arthropods and things like that. And then it came out saying, well, look, this is a, you know, a tiny spider with a tiny brain that nonetheless has this complex behavioral patterns. It has object permanence. It has these very adaptable hunting strategies, which appear to be being deployed with intelligence, even though it doesn't really have the toolkit for it. What if this creature had a chance to evolve and become the dominant species? What? And although, I mean, there's a certain amount of biological evolution, but I'm also very interested in the book in what sort of social evolution would you get once it was at a level where you had a society arising and that kind of thing. And it's the same kind of thinking that then went on to inform Doors of Eden for a variety of different scenarios. But it's just that it is just that, what if? It's an idea I want to explore. So in a fantasy world, it might be, well, what if, say, with Tiger and the Wolf, what if you had a world where everyone is a shape changer? You know, you hit a point in life, you have access to an animal form, it's an instantaneous transformation that takes all your stuff with you. It has none of the negative baggage of being a werewolf, because everyone can do it, which is a fairly common thing with my fantasy, is the idea of making a fantastical idea, like principle, commonplace, and then looking at how that changes everything, rather than having sort of magic as a secretive thing in the background. And in science fiction, it's very much just sort of taking that what if idea and building the world around it to showcase it, and sort of incidentally in that process you get a plot and characters arising out of that. I mean, one thing I should say about writing tips and writing talking and things like that, every writer I know has their own particular way of going about things. There are things that extremely successful writers do that I know wouldn't work for me, that work extremely well for them. There are things that I do that won't necessarily work for anyone else. So it is very much, you know, as an up-and-coming writer, it is very much a matter of finding the techniques that work for you. And just, you know, taking in all the different approaches out there and seeing what fits and what doesn't. I mean, it's a very personal, very intuitive thing.
Yeah, I really love that you said that, because that's something that I tell everyone. It's like you read Stephen King's book and then you start coming to me about talking about adverbs and stuff, like, you never use an adverb. And it's like, these things, you've got to experiment and see what works for you.
I will die on a hill defending my adverbs.
Yeah, it's like you say, this is what works for some people, and it doesn't necessarily have to work for you as well. You've just got to try all different things. And this is one of the great things about having like someone like yourself come on the show, because you obviously do it your way, and someone might find and learn something about how you approach things that might just sort of be the last missing piece of the puzzle for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth noting. I mean, even within the genre, even within the science fiction fantasy genre, there are multiple different kind of styles that one finds being applied by, you know, by a variety of writers. So there is a very, very economic, what's called, I think, commercial prose that Stephen King is an absolute master of. And at that point, you don't want a lot of flourishes and so forth, because it is it's very sort of task-oriented, efficient, fast-moving writing. There are other areas of the genre which really positively benefit from what would seem criminal overwriting when applied to say the, you know, a Stephen King thriller. I can't imagine the writing of KJ Bishop or Mervyn Peake or someone like that without that Peter Beagle, for that matter, without that immense richness of language that's completely on the other end of that pole. And even in my own work, over time, as my style has changed, I've gone backwards and forwards between sort of different levels of language complexity, and also depending on the sort of book I'm writing, and depending on whether I'm writing a novel or a novella or so forth. So it is a toolkit sort of thing, and the point of a toolkit is you don't always use the entire toolkit. You select the tool that fits the particular thing you're trying to build.
Yeah, that's a really good way to look at it. Yeah. So if we get back to all the ideas, how do you know which ones are worth developing?
Well, okay, so this is interesting. This is something that gets more complicated as you go on.
Yeah.
So at the beginning, it was basically what idea have I had most recently, and therefore is the one that I'm currently excited about.
Yeah.
And there was definitely a kind of a shelf life. If I have not written about a particular idea in a certain period of time, it sinks back to the bottom, and probably I will not come back for it, because I'm blessed that I tend to have a fairly constant stream of ideas. As things have gone on, and as writing has become more of a professional concern, it's a little different. So I have kind of files where I've recorded all these ideas, so I can go back to them and refine them, put them together in different combinations. Because one of the things I have found is quite often I will have two or three ideas that arise quite independently, and then think, these ideas will fit together to make a complete book between them, and they complement each other. And that's definitely a later phase thing that I'm started. That means I have more kind of conscious control of how the idea process is working than I used to. A lot of the time now, I have a publisher who I can, you know, who has kind of a gap where I can fit a book into. I can pitch a book to Tor.com, or I can pitch a book to Pan Macmillan or whatever. Because one of the situations I'm in that is not that common is I work with multiple publishers at once.
Yeah.
So I've got about four different publishers I will normally try and place books for. And so it's a matter of looking down the list and thinking, right, what fits the sort of thing that they want? Do they want a fantasy? Do they want a science fiction? Do they want a novel or a novella? And what feels like their kind of book that they will like?
Yeah.
And you run into things like commercial considerations. So that, for example, I've got books out there I would love to write a sequel to, but the books have not done well enough, and sequels are a very hard seller, especially in the current market. The current market is very much standalone friendly and not terribly keen on series, not compared to the way it was, say, I think when I first got into print in the mid-2000s, sort of 2007, 2008, it was all series. It was great big fantasy blockbuster series. It was Malazan, Book of the Dead. It was the Game of Thrones. Song of Ice and Fire. You know, if you turned up with a fantasy book and you didn't say, yes, this book can have a, like 19 other enormous blockbusters following it, you probably wouldn't be given the time of day. Now, very much keener on standalones. It's very, very, it's been weird sort of seeing the shift. And whilst I have theories, I couldn't necessarily tell you definitively this is why things have changed. I certainly couldn't tell you this is where things will be next year.
Yeah. It is strange. Why do you think it is? I mean, what are some of your theories? Like,
I think, one of the things, but this is a thing that goes for both books and for TV series, is the fear of things not being finished.
Yeah.
And I think there is, although I kind of wish they weren't, there is certainly a body of readers who have been burnt sufficiently that they are only looking at a series if they know it's got a conclusion. And when you're talking about, even for a trilogy, that's like 3 years worth of books. And if the first book doesn't sell, then it may be a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy because the third book may not come out. Yeah. So it's a bit of a vicious circle in that one. But that may be why a lot of publishers are looking more at standalones as desirable. Or there may be other things that I'm completely ignorant about, because frankly, in publishing, nobody tells you anything.
You know, I'm always interested about market changes and stuff because I work in marketing as well. And I wonder if it's something to do. I mean, people's attention spans have shortened over time. But then again, people do, when especially certain genres, if it's an epic fantasy, people expect series, don't they? So maybe it's just the genres broaden that much and there's just different types of...
I think there's a sweet spot at the moment which seemed to be... I know a lot of writers of my acquaintance are specifically looking at, which is the... I guess it's not so much a series as a sequence.
Yeah.
So you have a set of books and they're in the same world... and they potentially involve some of the same characters, but you can pick up the third book and it just works out of the gate. You do not have to have read the other two. I mean, the absolute master of this is the second trilogy of novels that Joe Abercrombie brought out, which is Best Served Cold Heroes and Red Country, are not only sequels to the first three books, but also kind of linked with common characters, but you can absolutely read any one of them without having read any of the previous books, and it works perfectly, which is, frankly, a bit of a masterstroke of writing. But
yeah,
also, I mean, that was frankly now looking to be a bit ahead of its time, because I know a lot of writers are looking at that as the desirable model.
Yeah.
And certainly, one of the problems you have with series is there is always diminishing returns. No one is going to be buying book two who hasn't read book one. Not everyone who reads book one will necessarily buy book two. You know, there is kind of no way to game that to keep your numbers up.
Yeah.
And obviously, if you're a sufficiently sort of rapidly selling author, enough people are going to be buying books two, three, and et cetera to keep it going. But you'll always get that drop off.
Yeah.
I imagine it's literally someone has looked at some numbers at the kind of the publishing on the publishing side and thought maybe not series for a while.
Yeah.
It'll swing back. It always does, but
it does always come down to money, doesn't it? Especially in the publishing world.
Yeah. But I mean, I, having seen kind of the expansions and crunches over the last, I'm trying to think, how long has it been? It's been a good 15 years I've been in print, and it's been quite a wild ride on the sort of the publishing industry side. So,
yeah. Oh, well, hopefully it starts to calm down though, and we get a bit more certainty. So you do sound like you're very, very organized. Are you more of a planner or an architect, as like George R. R. Martin describes people? Or would you say you're someone who sort of makes it up as you go along, or likes to see where the characters and the story takes you?
I am an inveterate planner. My normal process is that I will plan out the plot chapter by chapter, and then most of the time I will break down each chapter into sections, and very occasionally where there's specific information usually that needs to convey, I may even break down a particular scene or conversation. That doesn't necessarily mean I always stick to the plan. There's always a bit of whiplash around in the middle. My own peculiar foible is I also never nail down the very end. So the final resolution, I leave to the momentum and trajectory that the book has at the time I get there. So I generally know, you know who will be present in a particular thing, a particular confrontation. I don't know how it will go or who will survive or things like that. And that's worked reasonably well. I've recently started playing around with that. I've got a book coming out around the end of the year called City of Last Chances, which will be my first fantasy novel in quite a while. With that one, because I wanted a kind of living city mosaic of characters, I did a lot of work creating the world, which is always where I start anyway. But then I just kind of let the action flow. So I just skip from character to character. And in general, the characters are fairly regular people in a fantasy city, in an occupied fantasy city, where there is an enormous sort of rebellion is kicking off, and they are trying not to be part of the plot of the fantasy book. Yeah. And so the plot is kind of going on in the background while everyone tries to avoid having anything to do with it. That was a lot of fun. And that worked surprisingly well. I don't think I'll do that as my normal process, but if I want to do that kind of book again, with that, just that kind of low-key life story stuff, it worked really, really well for that.
Yeah, I really love them stories. It's just like the normal people in a fantasy world, because I love exploring the sort of day-to-day issues that people have, but at the same time, I also like having wizards and magic and dragons. So, and it sounds like that particular story, it sounds like quite relevant as well, particularly with like everything going on in Ukraine. And so you find them, that's quite...
This book was written before that kicked off, although yes, it's been quite interesting thinking through that as I've edited. It's one of those things, given the sort of science fiction I write, you don't necessarily want it to turn out to be prophetic, frankly.
I know, but as you ever take inspiration from the stories that you hear on the news about people who are trapped in cities and besieged cities, do you ever get any ideas that way?
Yeah, I mean, it all goes into the mix. I mean, certainly there have been a few political jabs in some of my books, because frankly, it's been my only outlet to process a lot of the turmoil that's gone on in the world over the last several years. And it was either that or scream out of a window. It all goes in. And at the end of the day, it's not much of an outlet to try and affect the world with, but it's all I've got. And so writing a book that kind of has the underlying message of this bad stuff is bad is potentially at least doing some tiny, tiny thing.
I think it's a really great thing to be a writer, to be able to share ideas and show people different perspectives. And I that's what one of the things I love about it most of all. Well, and like you say, you've got the platform to be able to show people these things.
For what it's worth. I mean, at the end of the day, I think I probably at least saved the lives of a number of spiders over the years. And if that is my epitaph, then so be it.
Yes, making the world a better place.
One spider at a time.
So and you said there that you like always start with the world building.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us a bit about that process so we get into the actual heart of the writing and the plan?
Yeah, I mean, the thing with me is the world is always the thing I'm most interested in. I write books to showcase the worlds that I invent. And so I start with the world, and I will usually start with some basic what-if principles and then drop those in and see where the riffles go. So, if this is my starting point, what does that do to society? What does that do to people's beliefs? How does it, with the current series, if Earth got destroyed by this enormous sort of architect creature and humanity got scattered across the galaxy, what are the scars of that? What is the kind of the cultural PTSD that's brought? What sort of societies arise in the echo of that sort of enormous loss? And that is very much what that whole series is about. You can see it in the way that the main character, all the different ways the main characters are is inherently informed by the universe that they come from. And this is how I do characters, basically. I never start with the character. I start with the world and then think, well, who are the interesting characters that this world produces? Where are the friction points? Where are the interesting stories?
Yeah.
And backstories and kind of clashes that this world I've invented produces. And so I usually have about a week or so of fairly intensive world bashing to get a real sense of where it's from. And then I'll work out, you know, let's see, who are the casts that sort of suggest themselves from that? What are they doing? Where, you know, why are they together? What's going on? And almost always what's going on will be specifically trying to showcase the main point of why I started off with, why I sort of set to creating that particular world.
One of the dangers I always found with world building is doing too much, and then you having all this stuff that you're never going to use, which I still think is useful in itself because you get a better understanding of the place that you've created. But
yeah, my editors would agree with you.
So how do you know what to include?
I mean, I overwrite in my first, although in general my first draft is pretty clean, usually the one thing I always have to do is I have to go back and take out a truck worth of world building.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of scaffolding, basically. I put it on the page and that helps me fix it in my head. And then it also ends up kind of inherently being revealed in what's going on in the book. So later on, I can go back and think, well, actually, I don't need to talk through all of this stuff. It's, you know, it's terribly wonderful in a look how clever I'm being sort of way, but it's also complete. It slows down the action of the book. And so I take a chunk of it out, and then my editors come back with another enormous chunk that also needs to be taken out that I didn't have the kind of the willpower to take out myself, even though I probably knew it needed to go.
Yeah.
And so eventually it all gets winnowed down. But yeah, it's, I mean, honestly, it's one of those little knowledge is a dangerous thing situations. When you know about a thing, whether it's something you've invented or just an area of knowledge you have, the temptation to use a book like a soapbox to educate everyone in the thing you know is enormous. And it's really hard to then rein yourself in. Knowing about the thing is really, really important. Stopping yourself going on about it is then the other half of that equation. I mean, for example, I did in Leeds, I did several years of medieval sword training at the Leeds Armouries. And I was absolutely desperate to put that in books.
Yeah.
And I did. And it was very, very tedious because enormously detailed sword fights are an area where the screen is really, really much better medium than the page.
Yeah.
And so you have to take it all out. But the key thing, you leave in just enough so that, first of all, you are communicating all the principles of what you're doing, or sufficient of the principles of what you're doing to your readership. They're getting the benefit of all the stuff that you know. And also, to a lesser but personally satisfying extent, so that someone else who reads it and also has studied the things you've studied gets to give you a little nod saying, yes, I see that you know what you're talking about, which is always always very, very satisfying when that happens.
Did you find that like a really good experience for research then, like getting a sort of empowering your writing with knowledge, isn't it? Like you've got the experience of holding the sword, getting hit with a sword.
Well, I mean, it's also one of the things that surprised me, which was very useful, is you're doing medieval, we have books and manuals from the Middle Ages about sword fighting. You think, oh yeah, it's a great big lump of metal and you're slamming away at someone else. And no, it's a science, and the people who are writing about it are very, very intellectually engaged with how it works. And obviously it's a matter of life or death, but they're also, as well as learning the specific style of sword fighting, because, you know, there are various schools of how it was done at the time and various masters who had these books. Because, I mean, this is also about the time that printing is just coming in. So there was an explosion of literacy and an explosion of access to both to producing and to consuming books. But also, you know, the human body works in a certain way. And so you are learning a certain amount of the underlying language of how fights work that applies to any kind of style and any kind of weapon, because you know, joints and leverage and balance are all basically universal. And there would be a fair amount of crossover between, say, an Oriental martial art and a Western medieval sword fighting manual, because they're all working with the same essential toolkit.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And what about the sort of theme side of things? Because I find a lot of writers struggle with theme. I'm someone who always struggle with theme. But on the Shadows of the Apocalypse, I noticed that underneath the title, you've got these really brilliant lines that just sort of sum up what the story is about. So every hero must be tested. The greatest foe is the enemy within. And I just think these are like perfect little summaries of what the story is actually about. So is that
that's interesting, because those are not those are late edition. Those got us added in for either the most recent editions or the ones before. And I'm never the thing is, if I was able to sum up my work with pithy little statements, I wouldn't be writing 150,000 word novels. Those lines come from the publishers, and I'm delighted to hear that they work. But I cannot, for the life of me, do an elevator pitch.
Oh, I'm so reassured to hear that, because as has been writing the Buzzy book.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, it's not what I do. There are people. I mean, those are Pan Macmillan. There are people at Pan Macmillan who are very good at putting those little lines in. And to me, I'm thinking, looking at that, saying, is that really what the book is about? Because I thought the book was about all of these things. but obviously, you can't put all of those things on the book cover and expect it to be in any way comprehensible. So
yeah,
it would be like one of those weird word cloud things you get with all the different words and different sizes and fonts and things. So yeah, I mean, I'm glad that those are working, but I cannot in any way claim credit for them.
Oh, well, there you go. I like I say, it's reassuring for me to know that. You struggle with the these things as well, because I spent hours and hours.
The best ever pitch. This is so one of my earlier fantasy books, and still one of my favorite books of my fantasy work, is Guns of the Dawn, which is basically kind of Jane Austen meets Bernard Cornwell, a gentlewoman ends up in a Napoleonic style army. Because the war is desperate enough that they're drafting women into the army. After it was released, a friend of mine basically said, it's Pride and Extreme Prejudice. And I was just kicking myself for months, because we should have had that on the cover.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to ask you is whether you still encounter any challenges when you write.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, every so often, my planning isn't up to spec. I've had a couple of books where I basically got about two-thirds of the way through and realized it's not working.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, one of the drawbacks of being a planning-focused writer is you're not terribly agile when things are going wrong. And so I generally have to kind of unravel the book back to where it was last working. And the annoying thing in every single case is I'm absolutely aware that it's not working, but I stubbornly press on in the hope that I can somehow wrestle it round. And that never works, but I never learn. And so, I mean, with The Bear and the Serpent and with Doors of Eden both, I had a colossal sort of derailment where I then had to redo several whole chapters to make it all, to bring it to where I wanted to be. Or in the case of the Bear and the Serpent, the entire ending of the book had to change, because I realized that the ending was going to be a complete damp squib.
Yeah.
That invalidated everything else that had gone on in the book.
Yeah. I suppose it's one of them, though. It's, you always feel like tortured almost, that you have to change these things, that you've got to go back and redo all this work, and all the work that you have done is just wasted time. But
yeah.
You couldn't,
I mean, and that that never gets easier. But I mean, I think as you go along, as I've gone along, I've come to take more of a, I guess, what I'd think of as a professional view on this. It's just like, yeah, this is a thing that's going to have to do. I really don't want to have to lose this chunk of book that I really like, or lose this character I'm very fond of, and so forth. But it will be a better book, and that's the end thing. I mean, that's one thing. I did at one point go back through my old manuscript drawer, and I was able to, and have, you know, successfully put into print the two novels that I had written and tried to sell immediately before Empire in Black and Gold, my first published novel. Before that, it wasn't salvageable.
Yeah,
which was interesting because at the time I'd have sworn that everything was gold dust, and I suspect one of the things is I didn't have that discipline. And even though I was aware that things weren't necessarily working and that I really needed to go back and redo it, I didn't, and just plodded on to some sort of conclusion. And that just ended up with a very awkward, unbalanced, and sort of self-indulgent book.
I suppose it's doing these kind of things that you learn the biggest lessons.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, if I hadn't written all of those books that weren't actually terribly good, I wouldn't now be writing books that are of a publishable quality. I suspect that had I been more amenable to receiving outside criticism, there were probably ways I could have shortcut the process through kind of maybe writing courses or writing groups and so forth and so on. But I also know that I was so precious about the stuff I was creating that I kind of had to get there the slow way on my own. Because I would have just pushed back against, the best and most well-meaning criticism.
Yeah. And do you think that was what helped you sort of take your writing to the next level then, was opening yourself up to feedback from other people? And
I think it's something that every writer has to learn to do. At around the time that Empire and Black and Gold was doing the rounds is, I think, when I got to the point where I was actually able to listen to people properly and not immediately get defensive. And it's been a very long journey for me, and I hope most writers kind of find that realization more quickly than I did, because to a certain extent, through a lot of the, honestly, I mean, it's about 15 years of submitting and not getting anywhere before Empire was taken up by an agent, I suspect that I wasn't doing myself any favors with that kind of attitude. But it was just, I don't know that there was any way I could have snapped myself out of it. I think I just had to basically get to the point where I could take a more dispassionate view on what people were saying. And it's hard. I mean, I think it is absolutely essential, but it is genuinely really, really hard, because, writing, creating stuff like that is very personal.
It is, yeah. Like, you know, we do put parts of ourselves in characters, and our experience as well always finds its way into the stories. And you said you were plugging away for 15 years before Empire of Black and Gold got picked up. Did you ever in that time feel like giving up or think that it wasn't for you, or did you just enjoy it that much and get so much out of it personally that you just kept
going? I was going spare, to be honest. So I'd actually set myself a deadline, because I mean basically 15 years was 15 books. I didn't keep on polishing the same book as some writers do. I wrote a new book each time and submitted it and got it rejected, and then wrote a different book and just kept doing that. And I basically, after enough of this and getting nowhere, I basically decided, right, if I haven't got anywhere by my 35th birthday, I'm going to just chuck it in. It obviously isn't happening. Now, I don't know what I would have done had that been the case. I don't know if I would genuinely have just abandoned the whole business, or whether I would have said, well, 45 then, 45.
Yeah.
But as it happened, I got a positive response from an agent about 2 weeks before my 35th birthday.
Meant to be?
Well, no, I mean, that's the thing. I don't think anything is meant to be. I think that there is a colossal amount of luck. I think that, there's almost no universal advice for writers, because writing is so different. But one of the things I would say is there's some things you have control over, which is the quality of your work. And there are things you don't have control over, which is getting in front of the right person who is in the right mood on the right day to want to keep turning the pages, want to request the full manuscript, want to then, if they are an editor, fight for that manuscript in the meetings they have, as to, where a whole bunch of books turn up and very, relatively few of those books actually leave with a slot in the publishing schedule. None of that you can have control over, but what you can ensure is the thing that goes in front of those people is as ready as it's ever going to be.
Yeah.
I know writers who have not been published who are writing absolutely brilliant things. I know writers who have been published who you know, should be getting way, way more attention, both from publishers and from readers. There's a lot of chance. There's also a lot of kind of demography going on in that. I am very well aware that I am absolutely of that core demographic that comprises the majority of science fiction and fantasy writers. And that has certainly eased my way into the industry and helped keep me where I am in it. And that, whilst I have personally benefited from that, it's not exactly an ideal situation overall. So there is that as well.
Yeah, like I say, talk about getting your big break and stuff like that. What? You can't detract from all the hard work that you put in 15 years. It's like 15 years of writing 15 books as well. That's a lot of work, a lot of hours you've invested in. Yeah.
It's a bit like gambling. You can gamble and gamble and gamble. That doesn't necessarily mean that the time you put into it will be recognized. But obviously, if you don't put the time in, then obviously you'll get nowhere. So that's kind of the harsh equation that you're presented if you're trying to get published.
Yeah. I mean, what would you have done now, or what would you do now if you were starting out again and the world of self-publishing was there? What would you have done with all them books that you'd written? Would you have gone down a self-publishing route, or would you...
You know what? I suspect I probably would. And I suspect it would probably, in my specific case, and I'm not saying this as a general comment on self-publishing at all, but in my specific case, I think it would probably not have been a good idea because I am a terrible self-editor.
Yeah.
I really, really benefit from having other people to edit. And I don't think I would, whilst obviously as a self-published author, you have options for external editing. There are people out there who do that. I suspect I probably wouldn't have done, or I wouldn't have taken the editor's advice if I had. And therefore what I would have put out into that enormous sea of self-published books, in which it is extremely hard to differentiate yourself in any way. I would have put out books that would have vanished without trace. I would have found no readership. Because one of the things is, I think successful self-publishers are frequently people who are also extremely good at promoting themselves so that you can rise above that colossal number of self-published books that are being put out.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely not part of my skill set.
Yeah.
And again, it's a bit like the going to conventions thing. If it's the thing you can do, that is an absolutely viable way of building a career, but you have got to have that extra skill set as well as writing the books. You've got to be able to promote yourself.
I think it's something that a lot of writers aren't comfortable with.
It's a rare thing. I mean, I've listened to a very successful self-published author explaining his process, and it is this almost like this Rube Goldberg sort of machine of newsletters and offers and promotions, and using one thing to promote another thing to promote another thing, and just having this constant turnover of constantly reminding people, there is this book, there is this other book, there is this book, have a free book, all this. And if you can make that, if you can get that machine built and working, and if you have the energy and the focus to keep it going, it can be incredibly successful. And obviously, if you are a successful self-published author, you're doing very well because you are not sharing the money with anyone. Yeah. But it is a lot of work over and above actually producing the books.
Yeah, I think
because you're being your own publishing house.
Yeah, I think it's definitely the biggest struggle I've tried to take a hybrid approach. So because of work and marketing, I try and use what I learn day to day to promote my website, promote my books. So I have got the mailing list, and like you're talking about, the relentless sort of email newsletters going out. It's a lot of work, and because I only write part-time, and I only have to work full-time, unfortunately, so there's only a limited number of hours. And I definitely think the writing has taken a hit because I'm having to write a newsletter or edit a podcast episode, things like that. But I do get a lot of satisfaction out of it at the same time. So it's really difficult, especially in this day and age, to know where to put your time. But I suppose from your perspective, you focus purely on the writing, don't you? And
I'm fortunate enough to be in that position. I mean, even then, there's a certain amount of associated stuff. So I love the writing. I do not in any way love the editing. But the editing does seem to take up an enormous amount of time. And you know, you send things off saying, hey, I've gone through these edits, and they say, fine, here is the next set of edits. And it is this kind of constant round until the book finally comes out. And you know, a selection of other non-writing related activities that still have to be done. And it's a fraction of what, you know, if I was self-publishing and doing everything else, it's a fraction of that, but it's still there. And I am very lucky, I think, in that I sit down and I am generally able to immediately write, and I can write for a couple of hours and then I can go off and do something else. And whenever I want to come back, I can write again. And I mean, at the moment, because I'm doing some months now, I've been doing work for on a gaming project, and I've been doing a few other things. I'm you know, starting to push out into other areas, and I found, yes, there's a limit to how much I can write on one particular project.
Yeah.
But what I can do is, so I can write a bit of the book I'm working on, and then in the afternoon I can do some different stuff on a game project, and it doesn't interfere, which is a bit of a blessing.
Yeah.
I mean, one. So here is a genuine writing tip, which I think is one reason why I am able to press on like that is. When I'm not writing, a part of my brain is always thinking about what comes next.
Yeah.
You know, when I go to bed at night, I think, right, what is the bit that I'm writing next in the book? And that means that it is the first sort of couple of paragraphs are generally mostly formed in my head by the time I sit down. So whenever I sit down, it's straight on with it rather than sitting there thinking, right, here is the page, what am I doing? And honestly, it's a tiny thing, but I think the overall benefits of training my mind like that have really, really paid off over the years.
And it's just a matter of asking yourself that question.
It becomes habit very easily. Yeah. It's just like, yeah, you know, and it just means that the moment, you know, especially if you're juggling a lot of things in time, the moment you sit down with the, you know, at the computer or whatever, you're ready to go. It's like you've been pulling back an elastic band in your head.
Yeah. That's a really great tip. Psychological training, there you go. Adrian, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you today. I've learned so much and I've really enjoyed just chatting to someone so successful and so talented. If you'd like to find out about Adrian and his books, I've put the links for everything in the description. Have you got any upcoming releases? We mentioned a few titles there.
Yeah, so I mean, Eyes of the Void, which is the second Architects book, has just come out. At the end of this year, we have City of Last Chances, which, as I say, is a new fantasy book, which I am tremendously excited about because I had a colossal amount of fun writing it, and this is the one I've tried this different approach to.
Yeah,
there is also Children of Memory, which is the third children book, which is, I think, November in the UK at least. Like I say, in publishing, nobody really tells you anything. So those two coming out, and then there'll be a new novella from Rebellion early 23, which will be And Put Away Childish Things, I think, is the working title. I haven't had the edits back on that, so that title may change, because here's the other tip: you don't necessarily get to keep your titles. I think I keep about one in three of my working titles.
Oh, really? Yeah, it's best not to get so attached to your story. I was really interested by the gaming project that you've got. Is that like a sort of Elden Ring style thing?
It is. It's a bit of computer and a bit of tabletop. And other than that, I'm absolutely prohibited in talking about it.
Oh, right. That's fair enough. That sounds really cool as well. So I'll be sure to keep an eye out for that. So, thanks again, Adrian. And thank you to everyone for listening. Please do go check out Adrian's books. All excellent. Thank you for listening. And we'll speak to you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much again, Adrian, for giving up time out of your busy schedule to come onto the show and help us aspiring writers to hopefully someday reach the levels that you've achieved. So I really do hope, if you're listening out there, that you've found a lot of benefit and use from what we discussed. And Adrian did say he would be interested in coming back on the show in the future. So if that's something that you're interested in, please let me know. Email in at thefantasywriterstoolshed@gmail.com or drop us a message on Instagram. Don't forget, you can check us out on Patreon if you want more writing tips, tools, guides, classes, books, or a lot of them, well, pretty much everything is focused on fantasy writing as well. So if that's what you like to write, then you're going to find a lot of useful things there. If you did enjoy the show, please follow and subscribe so that you don't miss any future episodes. We've got some great content lined up. And if you did enjoy the show, a quick review means an awful lot because it helps us reach new listeners, and that's always a good thing. Another way you can help us do that is by sharing the show on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all them social media platforms, too many to keep up with anymore. And please get involved with our writing group as well. It's turning into a really special place. And if you're looking to connect with fellow writers to get feedback on your work and find a bit of support and build a bit of a network up around your writing to hopefully take it to the next level, and it's turning out to be that exact place to do that. So just click the link in the description to learn more. And that is all for me today. Thank you again for listening. Thank you again to Adrian for stopping by the Toolshed to share his wisdom. We'll be back on the 28th of July with more insights on fantasy writing. So until then, keep on scribbling.